bundled them to sell as rental-backed securities. A new financial instrument is born, creating a new housing bubble. Join me, Linda Olson-Osterlund, on a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. My guest is Laura Gottsdiener, author of How Wall Street Has Turned Housing Into a Dangerous Get-Rich-Quick Scheme Again. That's this Thursday at 9:30 a.m. right here on KBOO.
It's 9:31. You're listening to KBOO Radio. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia will be with us. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints. And at 11 o'clock, it's The Dirt Bag, talking about bees today with the president of the Portland Urban Beekeepers Association. And coming right up, we are going to go to Radio EcoShock today, reporting on Fukushima updates. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm your reporter, Alex Smith. I need to alert you to yet another disgusting development coming from the world's nuclear mafia. It's a general go-ahead to dump hundreds of thousands of tons of radioactive water into the Pacific Ocean. Incredibly, everyone from the American head of the NRC to the International Energy Agency and Japanese authorities are giving a green light to empty those thousands of radioactive tanks at Fukushima right into the ocean. Who gives anyone permission to make the seas more radioactive? Why can't the country that used dangerous nuclear power keep the inevitable mess to themselves? Let's dig in deeper to recent developments at the triple meltdown that is the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear catastrophe. It's hardly worth mentioning Fukushima has set a new all-time record for radioactive pollution just this month. Listen to this from Arirang Korea TV News, December 2nd, 2013.
Now, media in Japan on this Tuesday are reporting that the level of radiation detected in an observation well at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has soared to an all-time high. Plant operator TEPCO said that 1.1 million becquerels of beta ray-emitting radioactive material had been detected per liter in water samples taken on November 28th. The figure is 36,000 times higher than the normal level of 30 becquerels per liter and is more than the previous record high of 910,000 becquerels per liter detected on November 25th.
And people try to tell you this accident is over. According to the nuclear industry, 1 million becquerels of radiation is equal to 1 kilogram of what they call low-level radioactive waste, here found in every single liter of water. Water is now the huge issue at Fukushima Daiichi. Estimates of the amount of highly radioactive waste being pumped every day are hard to get by, or they vary widely. The consensus seems to be about 600 tons a day needs to be stored, perhaps 300 tons being pumped by TEPCO themselves into the underground buildings trying to cool the escaped hot reactor cores, and another 300 tons of groundwater flowing down that hill into the site and mixing with those cores. Those numbers are far too round and neat to be real, but they do give you the idea. All that is being pumped through a maze of makeshift hoses into over 1,000 tanks on the site. These tanks, we know from mainstream news reports, were shoddily made, bolted together without welding, by inexperienced workers dragged in from all over Japan. On December 5th, Reuters reported the workers were brought in illegally, at times recruited by the Japanese gangs. Workers admit they assembled tanks in weather that did not permit proper sealing. There have been regular leaks of highly radioactive water from these tanks. The Japanese admit up to 300 tons a day of water is escaping already into the Pacific, a continual source of serious radioactivity. The tanks were a make-do solution from the start. They are only designed to last until 2016. That's fast approaching. A new report from the Japanese Ministry of Industry says Fukushima, the site, will run out of room to store radioactive water within 2 years. What to do? Just dump it in the ocean, of course. Here is the alarming news. A chorus of nuclear authorities inside and outside of Japan are preparing you to accept this horrible plan. Here is a short list of the dump-it-all boosters, the first two as reported in Washington's blog. Juan Carlitos Lenhito, head of the IEA's mission to Fukushima Daiichi, December 4, 2013, quote, "Controlled discharge is a regular practice in all nuclear facilities in the world. And what we are trying to say here is to consider this as one of the options to contribute to a good balance of risks and to stabilize the facility for the long term. And here we have Shunichi Tanaka, chairman of Japan's Nuclear Regulatory Authority, quoted on December 4, 2013. You cannot keep storing the water forever. We have to make choice, comparing all risks involved, end quote. The chair of the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, Allison McFarlane, was in Japan on December 6th when she said, at a press conference at the American Embassy, that the International Agency for Atomic Energy's recommendation to dump radioactive water into the Pacific was appropriate. Still not convinced they are all in on this? From ABC Australia, back on November 20th, under the headline, TEPCO cleanup boss says Fukushima's radioactive water will be dumped into Pacific Ocean. In the interests of truth, and that's what we're all after, these authorities say the water must first be cleaned up of major radioactive particles like plutonium and uranium before it's dumped. They realize cesium will still be there when it goes into the Pacific, plus large amounts of tritium. They always say tritium is perfectly natural. Go ahead, brush your teeth with it. But that's not at all true. And then, they blatantly say that all operating nuclear plants leak tritium daily, which you seldom hear. I know it's true. But now they tell you to bless dumping Fukushima's problem into our common ocean. The authorities act as though the technology to clean up this water is working. The filter machine on site, known as ALPS, breaks down often, including this past December 1st. It has seldom, if ever, run at its stated capacity. Even if it could, ALPS does not remove tritium and has a backlog in those tanks of several years' worth to process. And remember, those tanks will be full by 2016 and weren't designed to last beyond that, so that's not going to work. Contact nukefree.org for more information on what you can do. Bottom line, do you accept that hundreds of thousands of tons, perhaps soon to be millions of tons, of highly radioactive Fukushima water will be dumped into the Pacific Ocean? If that's not okay with you, time is limited. Contact your government, reach out to your local public. Let's stop this next nuclear disaster from happening. The Pacific Ocean is not anyone's nuclear dumping ground. Heaven help the species who live there and all of the people of the world as we sleepwalk through this awful proposal. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Here's Jerry Williams with something that just has to get out to you.
At first, it seems like the usual story. Big mining company moves into an area, promising to generate local prosperity and to preserve the environment. As the search for fossil fuels and other natural resources turns more widespread and more extreme, it's a decision many communities may have to face. EcoShock turns to the story that is playing out in northern Minnesota, where citizens groups are waging a campaign against a proposed sulfide mine, the first in the state. It's ground zero for one of the country's most pristine and protected areas, and it's a case that could have wider impact throughout the country. We welcome Paula Maccabee, attorney and advocacy director for the organization Water Legacy. Welcome, Paula. Please give us a little bit of context and background about this case, where it's been and where you think it's going.
I think you put it in a nutshell that Minnesota really has some of the most outstanding freshwater resources in the world. We're not talking just about the Boundary Waters Canoe area, but also about Lake Superior, perhaps the greatest freshwater lake in the world. And what sulfide mining does is different from the history of iron and taconite mining in Minnesota. And the reason is the geology. Copper and nickel and palladium and gold are formed in a kind of rock that has a high content of sulfur. And when that rock is blasted out of the ground and ground up in order to extract the metals, the sulfur is exposed to air and water. And that sulfur turns into sulfuric acid. And not only are the sulfur compounds themselves toxic, but they leach or draw out heavy metals from the rock into either surface water, groundwater, or both. And that's why across the country, in a water-rich environment like that in northern Minnesota, there are no examples of sulfide mines where the result has not been a legacy of pollution, either to groundwater, which is drinking water, or to surface water, streams, and lakes and rivers, or to both. And that's why this is such an important issue and an important decision facing Minnesota.
Now, tell me a little bit about the PolyMet Corporation, which is proposing this sulfide mine. It's the one that's going to operate the mind, and I understand it's a slightly different kind of animal, so to speak, from previous mining entities that have worked in this area.
Well, Minnesota actually has a legacy of United States companies working in the taconite industry, and PolyMet is anything but that. It looks like it's a Canadian corporation, but that's really a shell company. And it's a shell company where almost the lion's share of the investment has come from Glencore International, which was initially based in Switzerland and was renowned or notorious as being one of the worst companies across the globe for labor strife and pollution. Now, in 2013, Glencore merged with Xstrata, which is a Chinese conglomerate. And this combined company has sales of about $200 billion a year. In other words, the company that is pushing for the PolyMet mine is not only bigger than the state of Minnesota as a whole, but bigger than many other companies. And what's even more troubling is that not only is the ownership non-local, not only is the corporate shell unlikely to have any other assets to go after if the project goes bad, but Glencore has made as an agreement part of its merger with Xstrata that for the first 8 years, all of its copper concentrate is going to China. And Glencore, as the joint venture, owns rights to at least the first 5 years of production. So we're looking at in northern Minnesota is northeastern Minnesota gets the hole in the ground. We get the legacy of hundreds of years of pollution, and this copper is going to be exported. So the value added, any value added production is going to happen elsewhere. And the profit making is happening elsewhere.
Well, the irony is that these companies always claim to be generating jobs and prosperity in the local communities. And they also say that they will leave the land the way it was, if not better. But you've indicated that sulfide mines have never really done this. And how is PolyMet matching or answering the criticism that there's no way that they can contain the pollution and the leaching into the groundwater and the habitat destruction?
Well, I think that PolyMet is not the first company to claim in their environmental review documents that they're going to be different, they're going to be unique. There was a study done by Kuipers and a number of other researchers that actually looked at all of the companies that claimed in their environmental impact statements that they wouldn't pollute, what percentage polluted? And the answer was 9 out of 10. So the fact that a company puts down in paper in a big document, in PolyMet's case, literally thousands of pages of documents, a rosy scenario doesn't mean it's going to happen. And in PolyMet's case, this is an unusually bad location to put a mine. PolyMet is proposing to put a mine on a site that not only is it now Superior National Forest, so the public is going to have to trade and get different land before this gets built and lose access to some 7,000 acres of what's now Superior National Forest. But the mine site that PolyMet is planning to put their open pit sulfide mine on is wetlands, and it's primarily peatland. So the ability that one might have in an arid climate to start from scratch and seal everything up with plastic and make sure there are no leaks is not even possible in a wetland environment. In the tailings basin, you got a different problem. PolyMet is proposing to dump its tailings on top of an old tailings basin built by a taconite facility. Now, this taconite facility for LTB was built in the 1950s. And taconite tailings, which are less toxic than sulfide mining tailings, at the time, 1950s, not a whole lot of sophistication. They thought this is just sand. So these tailings basins were built to leak. So now PolyMet is saying, oh, it's built to leak. It's designed to leak. It's a mile in diameter, but we are going to make sure that nothing gets out. That might look pretty on paper, but it doesn't match the experience at what has happened at sulfide mines and at sulfide mine tailings basins.
Well, explain to me how any commercial company can even have access to a protected forest area or, for that matter, surrounding areas that are owned by the local residents. How do they cut this kind of deal? What is the law behind their ability to do this?
Wow, good questions. The first question is, what is the law that would allow them to take Superior National Forest land? And the truth is, there are federal statutes that say a company can't just walk in and buy a national forest. What they have to do is find other land to trade that's of equal value. As of yet, there has been no process of determination of whether that land that PolyMet wants to swap for the 100-mile swamp and the headwaters of the Partridge River, whether it's really of equal value. And I have now filed 2 Freedom of Information Act claims to try and get access to see that appraisal and see what the factual basis is for claim that it's okay to trade away this national forest. So far, no documents. So part of it is we're going to have to take a really long, hard look. Is this an under-the-table deal that makes no sense, or are these lands really of equivalent value to the public so that the public, we as taxpayers and as people who enjoy the forest, are not subsidizing a mine we don't want? You asked another question, though, and that's what happens to an individual? And Minnesota has really unusual law for mining. This does not happen for other industries. Other industries, if they want to buy my house or if they want to dig a hole in my property, they have to negotiate with me in good faith and we need to make a deal. The way it is in Minnesota, the state of Minnesota retains mineral rights under 13.5 million acres of Minnesota. That's approximately 24% of the state. And law was written 100 years ago favoring the mining company, saying if they buy a lease under my home or my business or my logging industry, and I don't want to give them access, I don't want them to mine, they have the right to condemn out my property and get an easement or get the right to use the surface, even if I don't want them to. Unprecedented in other areas, but it gives the mining companies, they may be negotiating with me, but I'm negotiating at the point of a gun if there's a potential for eminent domain. Citizens are just now waking up to this risk and starting to try and put pressure on the government to change the law or at least to give adequate notice and environmental review before the state sells these leases out from under private businesses, trout streams, whatever.
Well, I'm glad you brought up, you know, that citizens and the public are becoming aware, because I've seen what I would call a change in attitude. It is very sensitive for people living in areas where mining has taken place to feel that this is their only economic lifeline and that people outside of the area really don't have any say on it. I've seen signs that say those who reside should decide. But I've heard some pushback on that, in which people are saying, I may not live right next door to you, but this land is part of the commons. It's part of my watershed. It's part of an environmental legacy I want to pass on. I'm wondering what you are hearing in response to citizens around the state and their involvement in the campaign to the campaign against this sulfide mining.
Well, the campaign to prevent pollution and destruction from sulfide mining is very strongly based in northeastern Minnesota. It's not just a phenomenon of people who live in the Twin Cities. Water Legacy, we now have, I think the last time I looked, about 6,700 members. 2/3 of our members are from northeastern Minnesota. And many of them say that they don't oppose taconite mining, because if taconite mining is done properly and there are treatment facilities for their wastewater, it is possible to comply with water quality standards. But they're saying we need to draw the line at sulfide mining pollution and destruction. And we also need to make sure that the state follows the law when they're dealing with taconite mining. So there are a lot of people in northeastern Minnesota who are saying, I can support existing taconite mining. I just want them to do a little better job of it. And I don't support the brand new risk of toxic pollution from sulfide mining. I think people from other states might not realize this, is how important the tourism industry is in Minnesota and how much of northeastern Minnesota's economy depends on having high quality resource values. And that's not just in the boundary waters. It's the lakes that you can swim in, lakes that you can fish in, the fish that you can take home and you can eat. One of the terrible problems with sulfide mining pollution is between the mercury that's emitted and the sulfates that go into the water and increase bioaccumulation of mercury, as sulfide mining increases the degree to which toxic mercury contaminates our fish. And what that means for tourism is you can come up here and fish, but you can't eat the fish. And for our communities who are either subsistence fisher people or Anishinaabe tribes where eating fish is a vital part of their culture as well as their treaty rights? The answer, oh, just don't eat the fish, isn't going to work. It's not going to work for anglers. It's not going to work for tourism. It's not going to work for communities. By having sulfide mining, I'm not going to dispute. There are some jobs. There's a huge phenomenon of boom and bust, but there are some jobs. But what is being placed at risk is an economy, which actually the number of jobs in northeastern Minnesota, tourism has four times as many jobs as the mining industry. Are we going to put health? Are we going to put literally thousands of years of clean water? And are we going to put a huge portion of our economy at risk for what we know has been historically a boom and bust resource extraction industry? Doesn't sound like a really good cost-benefit analysis to benefit Minnesota.
I'm glad you brought up some of the very severe possibilities of pollution, and one that's also very relevant to the native peoples in the area is what would happen to the wild rice areas, this unique grain that Indians have been harvesting, that's part of their culture, that's economic support for them, but is uniquely also sensitive, or could be, I think it's being still studied, uniquely sensitive to the pollution from the sulfide mining. How are the Native Americans involved in this campaign as well?
Well, I came into this 4 years ago, and what I discovered when I came into it is that much of the best science, much of the most highest degree of knowledge was really possessed by the Fond du Lac, Grand Portage, and Boise Fort tribes. And they're all, in American language, we call them Chippewa or Ojibwe, with their initial name was Anishinaabe. These tribes have been, for a long time, trying to serve as stewards for lands in northeastern Minnesota. What we don't always remember is these lands, initially, the land where the Polymet mine would be located, is lands that were ceded to the United States by the Chippewa tribes under treaties. And those treaties, that this is the law of the land. As a citizen of the American government, we should want our government to follow the law of the land. The law of the land says that these tribes should have the right to hunt, fish, and gather. If federal agencies approve projects that destroy the habitat so you can't hunt, destroy the water so you can't grow wild rice and gather, destroy the and contaminate the fish so you can't fish, that government acting on our behalf as American citizens is actually violating treaties. Wild rice, in addition to having cultural importance, it has legal importance. This grain should be protected, not just because it's Minnesota's state grain, which it is, or because it's delicious, which it is, or because it actually has more protein than other rice. All is true. But because there's a treaty, and we're supposed to be following the law and protecting the resources that we promised to protect.
Well, Paula McAbee, to wind up, I'd just like to know where you are now in the review process for the permits. And as we get to the end game here, ultimately, who decides?
Well, where we are now, PolyMet initially came out with what they call a draft environmental impact statement in 2009. And that's a sort of a summary of what they think their impacts of the project are and what the project should be. At that time, there were about 3,000 citizens who commented, and the Environmental Protection Agency, which is a federal agency, looked at the draft environmental review documents and said the study itself is inadequate and the project would be environmentally unsatisfactory, and basically told the PolyMet proponents to go back and do some more work. Well, it's several years later, and I have read now the preliminary new environmental review documents and their track changes version. And my opinion is that the environmental impact statement is still inadequate and the project is still environmentally unsatisfactory and would harm irreplaceable wetlands and would also result in hundreds, if not thousands, of years of water pollution. But this time, we have worked as a coalition, a number of environmental groups, citizens groups, faith groups, and we've got the government to agree to have a process that's open to citizens. There will be public meetings, one in the Aurora Hoyt Lakes area, one in Duluth, and one in the Twin Cities, where people can come and they can actually have their voice heard. And there will be a chance for them to hear other citizens and have their words taken down by a court reporter so that someone will be paying attention. Now, how is the decision going to be made? There are lots of places where PolyMet's project could fall down. It could fall down because the environmental review documents are still lousy. It could fall down because a project has to the state has to certify that a project will comply with the Clean Water Act or it shouldn't go forward. So there are lots of layers of review. I think eventually, assuming that commodity prices are high and the marketplace is not saying this is a bad idea, it is quite likely that this case will either be decided by politicians saying, no, enough is enough, or by courts saying, this project does not meet the requirements of the law. And so what citizens can do to be involved is to help, first of all, get informed. Get informed. Get on the waterlegacy.org website. Learn more about the project and talk to people. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to your elected officials and say, you expect them to care about the future of Minnesota clean water and the health of the next generation and not just the job for today, because we as a community are going to be here for generations. And so whether this decision is made at the federal or the state level, all of these folks are politicians and they're all listening. So what you say in testimony, what you say in a letter to the editor, on your own Facebook page, in a call to the governor, and the governor will take call. All of these are important ways for community to let the people in power know that we're watching and that they're accountable to protect us and our clean water.
This is Jerry Williams for Radio EcoShock.
If you who are listening would like to get involved, hop onto the website waterlegacy.org.
Thank you, Paula McAbee, Advocacy Director and Attorney for Water Legacy.
Tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up, it's Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on the Dirt Bag, we'll hear about the second annual beekeeping edition that host Glenn Andreessen is presenting today. His guest, Jim Gilbert. And he welcomed Portland Urban Beekeepers President Tim Wessels to talk about beekeeping in the city. And they'll also discuss the aftermath of the Arctic cold blast and how to evaluate the health of your plants. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thank you, KBOO members, for your great support out there. If you're not a KBOO member, you can go to the website kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And after a couple of announcements, we'll go right to Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland. More information about the show can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza,
1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Cascade. Today is Wednesday, December 11th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We have a lot to talk about today. Frances Heathering, the Conservation Director of Cascadia Wildlands, is back today to talk about the aftermath of the decision in Salem yesterday regarding the clear cutting of the Elliott State Forest. And Kishama Savant